4009, United States versus Latchin.
Good morning. May it please the court, Bill Tice for Sammy Latchin. This morning we'd like to focus on the insufficiency of the government's evidence as to the 1425A count. And that raises the issues of materiality and procurement. The Supreme Court in Kunji's has set out a definition of materiality in immigration cases. At the instructions conference in this case, the government conceded in response to a very pointed question by the district judge that they had not met that test as it was set forth in Kunji's. And on appeal, they really have not backed away from that concession. And instead, they have tried to tell this court that there's a somewhat different test of materiality. According to the government, materiality is whether a true answer would have provoked further questions, but without any regard to what impact the answers to those further questions would have had. Now, that view of the law is wrong, and I'll get to that in a second, but there is sort of a pesky procedural problem that the government has in trying to espouse that position. Because if you look at their brief, they spend a lot of time saying that the district court's instructions about materiality, which were based on Kunji's, were wrong. Now, as we all know, the government doesn't get an appeal with respect to wrong instructions by the district court. And as I said, the instructions were right. The court's view of the law was right. But that's a pesky procedural problem for the government. An offshoot of that is they spend a lot of time in their brief saying that the district court's instructions on materiality were wrong. But the one thing that they didn't acknowledge, and I didn't even catch this until I was preparing for oral argument, is at the instructions conference, and this is on page, I want to make sure that I've got my page number right here, 1088, after a lot of discussion about the instructions on materiality, the district court finally said, okay, we have no objection to any of the portions of defendants number two, and that's the instruction that the district court judge gave. So even if they had, in general, some right to appeal what they considered to be wrong instructions, they surely don't have it in this case because they acknowledged in the instructions conference that the instruction the court was contemplating was acceptable to them, and that was the one that was given. And it is in light of that instruction that the evidence should be judged.
Is it your argument that the answers on these naturalization application forms, the answer itself has to be disabling in and of itself? If there's a false answer, that has to result in denial of the application, some sort of but-for causation.
We're not taking that position, Your Honor, but we're not rejecting it. And let me explain why. In Kunji's, and materiality and procurement seem to be very wrapped up in Kunji's. In Kunji's, after five of the justices say this is the test of materiality, three of them, led by Justice Scalia, say, we want something more than the fact that the person gets citizenship, but we reject a but-for test. And Justice Brennan is one of those three justices. But then Justice Brennan writes a concurrence, and I suppose philosophers could debate without end as to how much he takes away from that. And then three other justices, led by Justice Stevens, although they don't explicitly say we're in favor of the but-for test, in my view at least, they do speak out for the but-for test, and certainly it was Justice Scalia's view that they spoke out for the but-for test. So in terms of the precedent, but-for is really up in the air because the Supreme Court has left it there. And the reason we're not taking a position that but-for is required is because under the evidence that was presented in this case, regardless of whether you use the Stevens test, the Scalia test, the Brennan test, the government failed. They said all along the only thing we need to do is to show that more questions would have been asked. What would have been the outcome as a result of those questions, that's irrelevant. And clearly, even Justice Scalia...
You take a look at this case, and the background is very interesting, obviously. Had an examiner known that this fellow was an Iraqi agent for a period of time, that would have, I would think, caused an examiner to raise a red flag and cause an examiner to ask more questions or give further consideration. He never disclosed any of his contacts with the Saddam Hussein regime.
And that
apparently he received after he was here.
Well, and I'd like to speak to that. Your sense of what an examiner might have done is certainly a very natural reaction. I dare say if we got 50 people off of a CTA bus and gave them a thumbnail sketch of the case, they'd probably have the same reaction. Some of them probably even say that they would never give Mr. Lachin naturalization. But the problem is that the government very consciously and deliberately never put into the record the sort of testimony that is always found in these cases, whether they're civil or criminal. Someone comes in from INS, I guess it's now called ICE, and says, you know, if we had known the following facts, we wouldn't have given citizenship, or we would have raised a red flag.
The Greeks, since Greece is involved in this as well, there's a great Greek saying that, which is obvious, but it left unsaid. If you can't figure out that by disclosing that you're an agent of the Iraqi government, you're going to run into a problem of somebody giving you citizenship in the United States, and everybody's too obtuse to be involved. It's just,
you know, Your Honor, I can't really agree with that, and it's because of the few things that are...
You think the government, the American government, would have just breezed by the fact that he was an Iraqi agent, undercover agent, Secret Service agent, a spy to be precise, and let it go at that, and not do anything, not deny him citizenship. Why do you suppose he didn't disclose that information?
Well, you know, what we're talking about is something that it's not as straightforward as coming in and saying, I was an Iraqi spy, because those weren't the questions. Right. And let me talk about why it's so close. There's a question about employment, and says, who were your employers in the last 5 years? And it was the government's theory that he was an employee during those last 5 years. But their own witnesses said he was a retiree. And that's not what the form...
He was what?
A retiree.
He didn't tell that either, did he?
He wasn't asked that. And if we're talking about denaturalizing...
Well, they asked about his employment and where he worked.
In the previous 5 years. So when he came in, when he answered those questions on the written form...
During that five-year period, he never received any compensation from anybody. He never gave directions to him. He never participated in the whole program. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that he received money, according to the government's evidence, from Iraq. That's something that is there, and because of the standard of review, we're not disputing that. But as we pointed out, receiving money does not make you an employee. And remember...
Well, that's one of the sure indications of employment, I would think.
Not under these facts, because these facts were...
Give money for... Because he's a nice guy, or used to be a spy, or what?
Well, but you know, we've got testimony that even I couldn't have made up because it's so favorable to Mr. Lachin. These people who were high level, in the know, come all the way from Iraq, even though they're not obliged to, and say, we had this program, and he was the only person in the program where someday he'd either run for office or become a lobbyist. But we never... Yeah, I know it's laughable, isn't it? It really is. But we never told them there was a program.
Which would be the worst, being a lobbyist or running for office?
Or an Iraqi spy.
But nowadays, maybe lobbyist is the worst. But the testimony from their own witnesses was undisputed. We never told him there was a program. We never told him he was in the program. We never told him to do anything. We never told him he'd be asked to do anything. They assumed he would want to get citizenship, but they never told him to get citizenship. So then, to come back to the question we started off with, if he had gone to an examiner and said, you know, when I was in Iraq up to 1992, assuming that the government's evidence is correct, I was an Iraqi spy, and they let me go. Now, what would have happened at that point? I would submit that really nobody knows, but you could imagine all sorts of things. They might have said, well, we'll give him citizenship. It's kind of funny, but it's unlike being a member of the Nazi Party. It's not a statutory bar to being a citizen if you're an Iraqi spy. He told us he used to be an Iraqi spy, so probably he's not a spy now. Or they might have said to themselves, you know, we have some doubts about him, but let's give him citizenship and let's follow him around and let's see what he does, which, reading between the lines, maybe is what they did in this case.
The last option is very unlikely.
You know, Your Honor, we're all speculating. I'm trying to play along, but at the end of the day, we're speculating, and that's the problem. The government put no evidence in the record about that, and that's why on appeal they switched grounds and said, oh, he wasn't attached to the Constitution. They never presented a single word of evidence about any of the requirements to be a citizen, and now they want to pull it out at the last minute.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Boutros.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Andrew Boutros on behalf of the United States. There is one principal issue on appeal here, and it is whether or not there was sufficient evidence for the government to convict Sami Khoshab El-Atchin of knowingly procuring, contrary to law, United States citizenship in violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 14.
Well, I think that's pretty well agreed by both sides. That's
yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
There are four elements, Your Honor, to the charge to a charge under 1425A. The first is knowledge. The second is procurement or attempted procurement. The third is naturalization or United States citizenship. And the fourth is contrary to law. The predicate contrary to law provision that the government charged in its indictment here was 18 U.S.C. Section 1001, the false statement statute. And it was through the false statement statute, Section 1001, that materiality became an issue, not through Section 1425A. Materiality here, Your Honors, has the same meaning under 1001 as it does under 1425A and as it does in terms of the general definition of materiality in our criminal laws.
So there's no question materiality is before us and that you had to prove it?
Yes, Your Honor, that we had to prove it under Section 1001.
I understand.
Yes, Your Honor. That is not in dispute. Materiality here, Your Honor, means natural tendency to influence or capable of influencing. And this is this stems from the Supreme Court's decision in Kunji's. And it is capable of influencing or natural tendency to influence, Your Honor, that we submit that we met that test of materiality here. Although counsel states, is it simply a question of whether or not the INS examiner would have asked more questions? It is not just simply a question of asking more questions, but would the INS examiner have conducted further investigation? Would the INS examiner, as Your Honor sort of alluded to earlier, have placed the application from the approval pile to the questionable pile or to look into further piles?
In other words, if we don't clear this up, this guy's got a problem.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. There are red flags here that we need to follow up on. And it is precisely those red flags that meet the definition of materiality here. And it really goes to the issue of, because of course granting citizenship is a question of discretion, and really it goes to the issue of, was there information that was either concealed or misrepresented that calls into question whether or not the INS examiner would have approved the application. Again, the issue is not one of but for, as the defendant suggests is the case. The issue instead is one of capable of influencing or natural tendency to influence. The government also submits that the requirement of ineligibility is not a requirement of 1425A. That, Your Honors, is a requirement or an element of 1425B, a statute that was never charged nor mentioned in this case, notwithstanding the fact that in the jury instructions conference and in the jury instructions that were submitted to the jury, in fact, a 1425B element did creep into that particular, did creep into the jury instructions given to the jury.
So you're saying he got a more favorable materiality instruction than he was entitled to?
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. The government met and embraced a more difficult and a more onerous materiality standard in this case, one that made one in which the government had to prove that the defendant was ineligible for citizenship, although it is not a requirement under 1425A. And the reason, Your Honors, that 1425, the reason why ineligibility is not a requirement is because one can conceive of certain situations in which one would be perfectly qualified for citizenship.
Well, what do you have to do on appeal now? Do you have to meet the standard that you embraced when you charged, or the standard that you embraced when, for some reason, you acquiesced to a statute or instruction more favorable to the defendant?
This is a fortunate case, Your Honor, where I submit we can meet it under both tests. And the reason, Your Honor, is because we embrace that standard, and we are reviewing the case here under a sufficiency of the evidence standard of review, where the facts are viewed in light most favorable to the government. And under that standard of review, Your Honor, I would submit that we would meet either standard, whether the fair inference standard, which also contained within it.
Well, let's just assume for the sake of argument that you can't meet the more stringent standard, the one embodied in your instruction. Do you still prevail on appeal here?
I would submit we do, Your Honor, because there was an error of law in terms of the materiality standard that was given to the jury. The district court, during the instructions conference, was apprised that ineligibility was a requirement when it was not. And ultimately, although the government did end up agreeing to the higher burden or to the higher standard, the government would submit that that
Why shouldn't that bind you now? The fact that you acquiesced.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's because it's a if the court were to go back and look at a question of error of law here, and reexamine that particular question, then I would submit, Your Honor, now that the error has been brought to light, that the review should proceed under the correct interpretation of the statute. Although, again, Your Honor, I would submit that in this case, and with the facts of this case, we would meet either the fair inference test plus the ineligibility test, which is a higher standard that we need not have met, but we did.
If I understand what you're saying, the fact that you decided that you would let go the materiality for whatever reason, it's a higher standard, does not affect the charge that was made and the law requiring what you have to prove to meet that charge. Is that correct?
That's right, Your Honor.
So that the instruction itself would then be not material to the issue if we could get to our materiality.
That's right, Your Honor. And although, Your Honor, we certainly tease out everything that happened down below at the instructions conference and before the district court, we do so because I think it's important to give context to the issues that are here on appeal. Since the defendant is complaining that the instruction was erroneous.
No, he didn't say that.
What he said
was that you didn't meet that standard.
Well, Your Honor, the chief...
You didn't meet the standard of the instruction.
He says that, Your Honor, but in addition, the appellant also suggests that it was error for the district court not to deliver his proposed instruction one.
Oh.
And his proposed instruction one had to contain three particular elements. The first was, did the defendant procure naturalization? Was he eligible or ineligible for naturalization? And third, did he have knowledge that he was not eligible for naturalization? The appellant suggests that it was error for the district court not to submit that. And therefore, we thought it was that to add context here, that it was certainly ironic that Mr. Lachin ended up actually receiving an instruction more favorable than what he was entitled under the law. And, Your Honor, Judge Evans, you also asked when we were during, you asked earlier whether or not in this particular case it seems, you said, is it likely that an INS examiner who had all this information, had she known that he was in fact an Iraqi intelligence officer who was planted here by Saddam Hussein, had she known that he was working for the Mukhabarat, and had she known that he was taking international trips to meet his handlers to receive his salary, would he have received payment? And I think would he have received citizenship? And I think, Your Honor, that you touched on the issue that was in dispute in United States v. Rogan, which is the definition of materiality there, where this court held that materiality needs to be looked at through the lens of objectiveness. It's an objective test. Is it objectively reasonable that a foreign intelligence officer working for a hostile nation would be granted United States citizenship? And we would submit, Your Honor, that objectively, that is completely unreasonable, and that such an examination, such a grant of citizenship would not objectively have happened. And, Your Honor, you also asked the question whether or not why...
That necessarily follows. I mean, I think your best argument, but to me, the argument that it would require more looking into is the strongest point. To say just because he was an Iraqi agent, maybe he was defected after that and gave information that was helpful to the government, and the government might want him then to get a benefit of citizenship. So, the as I understood your argument initially, it's that had he fully disclosed these prior connections, the money he received, what he did, the activities with the, I guess, the Christian Iraqi groups here, had he disclosed that, more, a closer eye would have been put on his application. It would not have been necessarily disapproved at that point, but at least it would have required more investigation or more thought. And I think that's, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's what I understood your primary argument to be here.
And it still is, Your Honor. I just point out through United States v. Rogan that the test for materiality is also viewed through the lens of objective, through an objective test or an objective lens. But absolutely, the question here of materiality is that bedrock principle of capable of influencing, natural tendency to influence. Would the investigator have put that application to the side and asked more follow-up questions and looked into that application further? And indeed, Your Honor, we submit that right there is the test of materiality, and that the evidence here shows, and Ms. Reyes here testified, Examiner Reyes testified, that indeed she would have done just that, that she would have asked more questions, that she would have followed up with her supervisor, and as a result, that she would have taken a closer look at that application. And she also testified that the answers that were given to her, both in the application and when she met with Mr. Lachin for his examination, in-person examination, that she relied on those answers and that those answers made a difference to her, and that as a result of the answers that were given, that she approved his application on the spot. And so indeed, Your Honor, we think that the test of materiality here was indeed met. Also, Your Honor, the issue of retiree sort of looms large in the briefs. Your Honor, two or three points with respect to the issue of retiree. First, there was testimony here that Mr. Ali said that he was told that Sami Lachin was a retiree, which is completely consistent with the fact that this is a secret program. It's completely consistent with the fact that no one was to know who was being planted overseas. It was completely consistent with the fact that the person who was planted overseas needed to completely sever his relationship with the Mukhabarat, could no longer go to the ISS headquarters in Baghdad, that he could only communicate through his handlers, and that there needed to be distance between the planted agent and the intelligence servants back in Baghdad. But here, the very sheer size of the payments and the amount of the payments here in question, and we go through this, Your Honors, in great detail in the briefs, completely undermine any notion that Mr. Lachin was somehow a retiree. In fact, Mr. Ali, Mr. Lachin's first handler, testified that Mr. Lachin was a quote-unquote special case. It was a special situation. And he was special because he was one of the very few who was planted throughout the world, the only one here in the United States, under this program that was designed by Saddam Hussein himself. And so, Your Honor, there is no basis here. There certainly is, I should say, there was sufficient evidence for the jury to conclude that Mr. Lachin, A, was not a retiree, that he was an employee, and that that would be completely consistent here with the testimony that was presented. It's also important to highlight that there was no date restrictions, Your Honor, on the affiliation or the membership question here. The question about affiliation and membership goes back to and covers all periods of the issues in contest here, and certainly would cover the periods in which Mr. Lachin was an active intelligence officer working for the Mukhabarat, stationed in Athens and back in Iraq. If there are no further questions, Your Honors, I would yield my time.
Okay. Mr. Dice.
I want to go back briefly to the procedural point about the government's agreeing to the instruction. You know, we're not invoking some, nitpicky little prudential rule about parties can't change positions, although I think we'd all agree that's an important rule. We're talking about the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment. And Dunn and Chiarella, which we've cited in our reply brief, are clear that when the jury is given an indictment and given instructions that embody a particular theory of liability, that is the standard to which the government is held on appeal. You know, the government can't say, oh, we'll be magnanimous and give the defendant an easy standard.
Of course, what the government says is other either theory, they met the burden.
That's true. And that's the second point I want to come to. Cungies has made it clear that the standard of materiality is not just the red flag. Some of the cases talk about the red flag. But when you look at Cungies, what they talk about, and this is the important language from the portion of the opinion, or the opinion that was joined in by five of the justices, whether the misrepresentation had a natural tendency to produce the conclusion that the applicant was qualified. And so in order to judge materiality, we have to know something about the qualifications. And it's not good enough to say, oh, well, we would have raised a red flag. And then when you start talking about qualifications, you have to...
Wouldn't you say that as a matter of common sense, a agent of a foreign government who had failed to disclose this has misled the government into giving him a citizenship?
Your Honor, I can't agree with the conclusion that at the time he applied, he was an agent of...
My question was in the abstract, not in the concrete. If someone who failed to disclose to the examining officer that he had been a agent of a foreign government, that was particularly a foreign government in which we were engaged in a war...
Well, not at that time, but...
Well, what year were we talking about?
1998 and 99.
Well, there was a continuing conflict, if I recall correctly, between the government of Saddam Hussein and our government, right through to the time they pulled him out of the foxhole, or the spider's hole, whatever. Am I correct in my analysis?
I've heard that, yes.
Well, at least we're on the same page. Wouldn't you say that the failure to disclose to the agent was misleading the government? And it's very, just superficially, if you went no farther than that.
The problem is the government consciously chose to present no evidence. If you're asking me if American citizen would be happy about former Iraqi spies...
No, I'm just saying not whether you're happy about it, whether you think the government would be a little nervous about just hauling off and giving him a citizen.
Well, I don't know. And the reason I don't know is Mr. Abdani, who was someone with far more involvement and someone with far more hostile intentions towards the U.S., and he gets the citizenship and $1 million.
Listen, we don't know. What the government does is frighten me over the years, but the fact of the matter is every now and then they're supposed to do something right, and they have to be told what the facts are. But your time has expired, and so...
Okay.
Thank you to both counsel.